From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. And Tom's reading levels have improved so much that it is my understanding that today he was able to read to his classmates in kindergarten and first grade at Whittier Preschool here in Washington.
They're not my classmates.
Oh, I thought you were.
Although, you know, I forget sometimes how tall I am when I go around little children. But it was very nice.
Whittier you had look like a giant
there.
To them.
Parent Julie Lawson invited me, and even with this Southern accent, I was able to read both the Lorax and the Hungry Caterpillar to some classes. I did it with probably more emphasis than I talk on this program.
You acted out all of the roles?
I had all the right facial expressions.
And the young people enjoyed it? They were not afraid of you, despite
no,
the fact
I always worry that I'm so tall that when I'm around young kids, I think they might be afraid. But they were very well behaved, and the teachers should, and the whole school gets great credit for the work they do. And they also were having a breakfast for fathers and sons there, but I couldn't stay to eat because I had to come over here.
I am sure there are several schools in Ward 6 of the District of Columbia that would love to have Tom Sherwood come over and read. Our first guest today is Charles Allen. He's a member of the D.C. Council. He's a Democrat representing Ward 6, so you can check with the schools in Ward 6 to see who wants Tom and especially who doesn't.
Well, with the waiting list that we have for our Ward 6 schools, we'll see if we can't get Tom in there.
It'll be really embarrassing if no schools, all the schools,
you know,
no, thank you.
I live in Ward 6, just to be clear.
This is true. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Mark Elrich. He's an at-large Montgomery County Council member. But, Tom, first let's talk Virginia. Do you know, according to a report in the Washington Post, that there are 61 women who will be seeking a seat in the primary elections for the Virginia legislature coming up, about 30% of the field? According to the Post, the overall crop of 206 candidates is bigger than usual, and the number of women may be a record. The 50 women running as Democrats are the most for that party in at least a decade and probably ever, up from 27, who filed in 2015. What's going on? Is that the Trump effect?
Yeah, well, that's what Stephen Farnsworth of University of Mary Washington says. And it is part of that. We're seeing this around the country. We're seeing it in the governor's race. Tom Perriello is not a woman, but he's running for governor, running against the Trump world, against Ralph Northam. Let's just cite the numbers. In the 100-member House General Assembly in Virginia, there are 17 women out of 100. In the Senate, which has 40 members, there are 10. So even though this is a larger number of women who are now running, they are woefully way behind.
Well, they intend to change that to some extent if they happen to get elected.
And most of them, let me just say, of those 61 who are women who are running in this campaign, 50 are Democrats, 10 are Republicans,
correct,
and there's one independent.
If you have questions or comments for Charles Allen, he is a member of the D.C. Council. You can call him at 800-433-8850. Send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. He also is chair of the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee on the D.C. Council.
I hate to interrupt you because you are the host. But before we get to him, can we talk about it very briefly, some breaking news?
Yes.
Kevin Harris, the mayor's third communications director, is out of a job.
Yes.
So this is where I'm trying to help people. If you are a good person with communication skills, you live in the district and you care about the district, the mayor is now looking for her third full-time communications director. Kevin Harris came from Baltimore in the Obama administration. He wasn't very well known, partly because he wouldn't go anywhere. He stayed in the office most of the time, and so now he's out. And
so they're advertising for a replacement.
Yes, they are. And what's really important here
is the scuttlebutt on why he's out?
Well, I don't think he was. He did. There are two things you do. You tell the mayor's story, and then you get to know the reporters, so you'll know what they're thinking before they do their stories. And he could tell the mayor's story, but he just didn't get out and get to know the media landscape to do what he had to do. And she's on the verge of announcing for, you know, her formally announcing for re-election. She's got to have her team in place. We know we have the police chief is in place, other people. And she's got some problems with the school lottery controversy and all those things. She needs a good communications director on her team, and she needs one fast. So if you want that job, give them a call.
Now is the time to apply. If you want to talk with Charles Allen, give us a call. 800-433-8850. By my count, there were at least 25. There was a party. Well, I shouldn't use the word party. There was a group of at least 25 people who attended this meeting, this conference that was held in where again?
Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas!
That's right. It was in Las Vegas, the International Council of Shopping Centers. The 25 people consisted of the mayor, 9 of the D.C. council members, and some 15 staff members. In a group that big, Tom Shaw, would you think it would be possible that a council member who said he was not there could have been hiding and was actually there? And what happened in Vegas stayed in Vegas?
I know of no shy retiring council member who could go to Vegas and hide it from us, including the one sitting here who did not go. Why didn't you go?
Correct.
Well, first off, I guess good afternoon.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was quite the intro. Absolutely. Thanks so
shy
much.
Shy and polite.
Yeah, you know, I've skipped the trip to Las Vegas the last 3 years. First off, if you know Ward 6 and the neighborhoods across Ward 6, I don't think anybody would make the argument that we are hurting for development. I find that I can be very helpful. I can work with development. I can work and be their partner. I can work with the community from right here in Ward 6. So I'm not sure what my value added is to go out to Las Vegas. I think there's a purpose, obviously, to having the mayor go out, the chair of economic development. But I want to spend more of my time focused on our local businesses, frankly, here. On Sunday night, rather than being in Las Vegas, I was at Eastern Market celebrating a lot of local businesses in the new Eastern Market Main Street. I spent a lot of time working with our entrepreneurs and our Made in DC effort. So that's just where I choose to put a lot of my energy.
As you know, former Mayor Tony Williams started this. And when they went out, they had a backpack and, you know, and a couple of free Cokes to give out at the thing. Now it's a huge thing. They have on the convention floor, they have an elaborate display. But they also point and say that real business, the Walmarts and other businesses have come here, that Wegmans was first talked to out there. So there is some business to it. It's not just a fun. Although if people want to complain, let's wait a couple of months and see what kind of expense accounts they file.
Well, I do think it's important for the city to be represented there. Right. I mean, I do think it is absolutely right for the district to be there, to be competitive and be trying to talk and tell our story about this is a great place to do business and to be recruiting those businesses. I just think that for myself, I work very closely with a lot of the development teams and the folks doing a lot of the work. I absolutely understand the value of bringing in kind of those anchor tenants into a development project, for example. But I also think there's a lot of effort and energy that can go into working on the small business, the local business, okay. And that's just where I'm going to spend most of my time.
Can I just take one moment? There are 9 of the 13 council members. I think I should say their names.
Well, you should say their names because we got an email from Marion Adams Morgan who says, I don't know how well our city officials did at the gaming tables, but here's a safe bet. None of the at-large members who went to Las Vegas will ever get my vote again.
Well, I don't know that person, but I would say I would try to judge people more than that. This going to Vegas, where it's the world's largest shopping center convention, and you get some work and business to the city, the businesses bring jobs, so you should at least give it some look to see if it's something serious. But it was Jack Evans, Brandon Todd, Kenyon McDuffie, Vince Gray, Trayon White, Robert White, Anita Bonds, David Grosso, and Chairman Phil Mendelson.
And the argument that they made, of course, was that it would bring business to the city. The pushback against that, Charles Allen, is that this city has now become so attractive for businesses that such a large delegation is no longer necessary. Is this city a place that has become so attractive for businesses that we don't need to work as hard as we did during, say, the Tony Williams administration to attract them here?
Well, I think it would be a mistake, actually, to ever stop promoting the city and trying to be recruiting businesses and getting those type of investments in the district. So I think it's appropriate for the city to have a presence and to be engaged like that. I have to make a choice. Every council member has to be able to answer that for themselves and what their choice is. For me, I want to spend my time focused in Ward 6, focused in the district, and working again with those small businesses, because that's what I think helps make our neighborhoods and our communities so vibrant.
If you're across the river from Anacostia over at Skyland, where Walmart bailed on the whole plan there, where there's a big empty land spot, somebody needs to be paying attention to that. If you go over Pennsylvania Avenue southeast, there are development opportunities there for the people who need, we have grocery deserts and all types of business that we need there. The question is, do people go and work? Is it a junket? If it's a junket and anyone knows the details about that, let me know. But it also the city, competes with Maryland and Virginia. It has to compete. And the council member's right. We don't have to send everybody there, but you have to send people who are working, not playing.
It's Memorial Day weekend. You are chair of the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee. Crowds are expected for events across the city, including a parade as well as a large annual gathering of bikers known as Rolling Thunder. It's my understanding, in the wake of the Manchester security bombing, that security is being stepped up.
Well, we're certainly going to have probably a little more visibility, a little more vigilance. I think that for a large-scale events, though, that's not uncommon here in the district, just as a matter of course. We are the nation's capital. I think we all understand that. And so I'm not surprised that you're going to see a little bit more of a presence and security presence, because we just realize the world we live in, and that we are the nation's capital, and that we are always a potential target. But I think the city is taking the right steps. I keep in very close touch with our Homeland Security and our police chief, and so they're taking every precaution to make sure that we keep a safe city and also welcome our visitors and our guests. So it's safe for our residents and safe for the visitors that come here.
As a chairman of the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee, are you privy to the secret discussions that the police department has? And they have that little command control room with all the TV monitors up there, and they plan all these things and watch over events. Are you told things that you would not, that you wouldn't be able to just say publicly about security? How much into the weeds of security do you get?
I couldn't tell you if I do know, right?
I knew that.
Well, we were hoping that you would.
Well, we are the nation's capital. I hate the word heightened. I'm very skeptical of security theater, and now what I wrote about this week called security envy, where every two-bit, that's not fair, where every person who has some form of power feels like he or she has to have a security detail, two big SUVs taking them around town. But I do know that security is serious, but you can also just scare the hell out of people, too, and we don't need to do that.
No, we don't. And I think we try hard to strike that balance. But I think we can't ignore the fact that we are the nation's capital. And so it's not a matter of if someone might try to cause damage or has sees the district as an opportunity. They do. And so, we work very hard. I'm in close contact frequently with our Homeland Emergency Security Agency, with the police chief, with Fire and EMS, with Chief Dean. So I feel like I am informed and certainly aware of what I need to be aware of. And I also know that we've got some professionals who know what their job is, and they go about doing it every day.
And they have to respond more. Just being prepared is one thing, and trying to prevent is one thing, but being able to respond and respond quickly is almost equally important.
You and your council colleagues passed the city's biggest budget ever, nearly $14 billion, but Ward 2 Councilmember Jack Evans expressed concerns about a growing budget with little accountability. The D.C. auditor, Kathy Patterson, is talking about it's time to measure outcomes, put money into programs based on performance, department by department. Harry Jaffe wrote a column in which he suggests the mayor's budget is simply rubber-stamped, that you are not going to challenge it a great deal. How will the council address those concerns?
Where to start?
Where to start with that? I'd be hard-pressed for anyone to think that the budget got rubber-stamped after watching the council's conversation yesterday. As somebody who just led about a $1.5 billion committee budget for all 31 agencies and 10,000 FTEs through my committee.
Full-time equivalent employees, FTEs.
Thank you, yes, the employees. You know, they're certainly not a rubber stamp. Um, I I'm pretty sure the mayor's not happy with every change that we made, and I think we made some smart investments that hadn't been in the original budget.
In the education committee.
In the education committee. I've been fairly critical of the investments being made in school modernization, as well as in what we call the per-pupil funding formula, which is how we fund.
Allow me to interrupt, because we got an email from someone who says, will the council increase Mayor Bowser's weak budget and put more money into school modernizations like Capitol Hill Montessori? You recall there was a sewage... There was sewage backing up there this week.
Yeah, well, that's what I was getting to. We are putting more money. We've been able to increase thus far through the committee's actions the funding that goes into our per pupil funding from a 1.5% increase up to about a 2.38% increase. And then on school modernization, we're working to put more money into school modernization. I've made a priority out of Capitol Hill Montessori at Logan. This is a school where, earlier this week, 2 days of raw sewage in their cafeteria, and I talked with the DGS director again today as they're on site making repairs to the pipes and the infrastructure. This is a school that I believe needs a full modernization, and it's not even on the capital improvement plan. And so working to map that out, get new funding in to be able to accomplish that is one of my big priorities. But back to your question, we are also a growing city. So we have more residents, more businesses, more jobs. So breaking news, last year's budget was the biggest budget that ever happened before
it's
that.
It's been the biggest budget
the year before
every
that, it was the biggest budget. We make investments, and what I think we've got to do is make sure there's accountability in terms of where investments are, that we measure, we have outcomes for the programs and policies that we put in place. But that's a big part of what we do, and I know as a committee chair, that's why I spend so much time on oversight hearings to really dig into the details and make changes, as we did to the budget as proposed, to try to be reflective of what we're hearing from the community and where we see the needs to be.
You know, I think you have to remember when people say, oh, they just rubber stamp the budget, they don't deal with, you know, the council.
Not people, Harry Jaffe.
Well, I don't want to mention any names.
Your co-author.
Particularly his. particularly that column. I just totally disagree with half of what he said. But here's the deal. You have a nearly $14 billion budget. The council members can make hundreds of millions of dollars in changes, and it doesn't seem like much, but it can reset priorities and move the city in a different direction. So it's not just the total dollars spent, but how they're changed.
Right. Well, let me give you a great example of that.
Well, so I was going to give one to you.
Well, how about I do one?
Oh, and then you go first.
You go next. One of the things that we did in our committee I'm very proud of is what's called access to justice. And that is that we're putting new funding into a program. Right now, about 33,000 people go through landlord-tenant
court. That's exactly what I was going to bring up, landlord-tenant lawyers.
Thank you so much.
Public defenders.
Are you a reporter or are you a council member?
Well, I could be either,
pretends,
but I'm a reporter.
He's the 14th council member. So this is an initiative that came from the council. And this is an opportunity where we are able to help set a priority and also help set a vision. And that is, again, 33,000 cases of landlord-tenant court. And in those courtrooms, if you can put yourself there, 90% of the landlords have an attorney. 90% of the tenants don't. And so we have created a system where there is gross inequity. And what ends up the result is that we have people who not only just lose their housing, but in the process, their credit is ruined. Their future and their opportunities spiral out of control. And
in the same time, they have to take off time from their jobs to go to court for just for some mundane thing and wait for hours. It's a horrible situation.
And if you are trying your hardest to be able to make ends meet and keep a roof over your head for you and your family, that's incredibly hard to do. Having legal representation, and that's what this will do. Not for everybody. It's only about $4 million, $4.5 million investment. So it's only going to be a fraction of what's needed. But what we've seen with experience in New York City and other places that have implemented programs like this, what it does is it helps get people to a resolution. It does not change the legal relationship between a landlord and a tenant. It does not change the expectations between a landlord and a tenant, but it does aim to change the outcomes.
Who is eligible for this kind of legal help? And how would they even know about it? Will it be told in the landlord-tenant court when someone goes, you qualify based on what, income or what? What is the qualification?
To be able to provide this just as a matter of course for everybody, and what people, the attorneys out there will know what I'm talking about when I say civil Gideon, to achieve what we can try to. Well, Gideon is when we decided that no matter whether you can afford it or not, you should be afforded legal representation in a criminal case.
Okay.
And so we don't provide you an attorney because it's possible you're guilty. We provide you an attorney because it's the right thing to do. It provides justice.
According to WMU's reporting, D.C. residents who make up to 200% of the poverty line, roughly $24,000 a year for a single person, $48,000 for a family of four, would be eligible
Correct.
For free legal representation for eviction cases in landlord-tenant court. I do have to get on to the phones. Back to the schools. Here is Maria in Washington. Maria, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I am a D.C. native, and I have three children that attend D.C. Public School. They attend Oyster Adams Elementary School. And my concern has to do with the development that has occurred in the city and is continuing to occur. I know that Councilmember Mary Che has proposed an additional subtitle to the budget with regard to banning tire waste surfaces from being installed in schoolyards and recreational facilities, and I hope that council members are supportive of getting that passed. But in addition to that, with regard to all of the schools, the playgrounds that actually have only tire waste surfaces on which children can play, we need to have a really serious and aggressive removal plan in place. And the removal needs to provide for replacement with dirt and grass, not replacement with other synthetic infills.
Let me see what Charles Allen has to say about that.
Well, thank you. And for anybody who, first off, thank you, Maria, for the call. For anybody who doesn't quite understand when we say tire waste surface, what we're talking about is the city has gone through and created artificial turf materials for our fields.
Yeah.
And the tires are essentially shredded into very small pieces and then become that rubberized element in there. And there's a lot of concern around that. So what Ms. Che has done is suggested legislation, which I believe will be a part of the budget, that moves forward, which would prohibit us from using that type of material.
I was at Rosedale yesterday, and it has a fantastic playground, all kinds of climbing things, and terrific. But it also has that rubberized, soft
on the field.
Field, yeah. And that's what we're talking about.
Well, there's different materials.
Spongy.
Not every one of those uses a tire waste, a chewed-up tire. Some of them are others. But I think to the caller's point, I think her concern is around just synthetic materials in general. And I think we do have some experience that not all synthetic materials are the same, but the argument I believe she's making is that, of course, a grass natural turf surface is preferable. What you'll hear from DPR and from the schools is they're just a lot harder to maintain.
Right, can it?
Thank you very much for your call, Maria. Allow me to go to Chris, who's also apparently a resident of Ward 6. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. Hi, Kojo. This is Chris Otten. I'm citywide, as you know, D.C. for Reasonable Development. And I want to thank Charles for talking about the local businesses, Tom. You know this is better than anybody else. The giant anchor stores, we have tons of folks in D.C., local entrepreneurs, ready to take on labor cooperatives, locally based retail cooperatives in the first floors throughout the city. And we want to promote this, so I'm really happy to hear Councilmember Allen talking about that. But to Buzzard Point and the soccer stadium, the people around there have appealed the planned unit development rubber stamped by the Zoning Commission to approve the soccer stadium. I want to know, Mr. Allen, what are you going to do now that they've done that to really, truly protect, maybe through land trusts or whatever, the folks of Syfax, of Greenleaf, of James Creek, the people around there, because we saw what happened with the baseball stadium.
Okay, allow me to have him respond. But you need to make sure those people are not forced out of their homes.
And those are public housing projects he
Correct.
Just described. Yes. Okay, go ahead.
Well, thank you. And yes, near where the proposed stadium site is Syfax and James Creeks, but there's also a lot of private housing around there as well. But I would take issue. I don't believe that anyone could call the PUD process that went through as rubber stamping. It was a fairly intensive back and forth that lasted for many, many months to get to that point. And a lot of changes that took place based on feedback from the community and from the ANC and from a lot of others. Is it in a place where every single person agrees? No, and you'll rarely see that. But I do just take issue with saying that there was a rubber stamping of a PUD. The issue, though, is around the housing. How do we help preserve Syfax and James Creek? Very important public housing. This is some of that public housing where you have 2, 3, 4 bedrooms, family-style housing.
And pretty good public housing. I bike through there all the time, and this is brick, solid structure things. These are not people sometimes
no,
say
this,
public
this is,
housing.
This is
you think
absolutely
it's falling
housing.
In.
Well. And what we should be concerned about, what I'm concerned about, is as we develop on Buzzard Point, an area which is currently concrete and industrial land, essentially, it is going to put economic pressures on the neighborhood. Well, I view that as part of my job. Part of my job is to protect the public housing and protect the housing that exists there. I've been fully committed to that from the very beginning. But I don't believe that because someone lives in public housing, therefore you should have to live next to a concrete factory. I think we should be able to bring jobs and amenities and business and make an area an attractive space and at the same time preserve the type of public housing so that everybody gets to enjoy from that investment. I don't think it's a fair argument to say that because you live in public housing, you shouldn't see development and you should just have to live next to a scrapyard.
Yeah, that was the light industrial down there with the cement plant and the power plant and all of that stuff. It's not something you want to live next to. But if you think about what's happened at the Yards Park area, mm-hmm. If you think about what's happened where I live over in Southwest at the Wharf area, this is what's envisioned for the area around the soccer stadium. And if it's done right, there will be job opportunities. The people who live in this public housing will be able to walk down the street to job opportunities. They won't have to worry about trying to get on Metro, which doesn't work. They can walk to their work. They can get all types of jobs, and they can bring in new revenue for the city.
Well, let's look just to that example. Look at Yards Park. Yards Park is a beautiful, beautiful park that has reconnected the Anacostia River to a community.
Adjacent
to the ballpark. But what it has done as well is it has, in my view, it has democratized the river, meaning that anybody has access to it. It is a place where everybody has their birthday parties. You will come down to Yards Park and you will meet essentially a cross-section of our city.
There's even a beer garden down there that has a sandbox for the children to play while their parents drink beer.
Well, here's someone
They might, but that's the type of investment that I want to see on Buzzard Point, is to create that type of park space and green space such that the river, which is too walled off from so many people, and parks along the water can be that democratizing effect.
Here's someone who begs to differ. You have got to be kidding. The tenants have ample time to and ample resources to avoid eviction. What about the money they owe when they leave? Back rent, utilities, repairs, etc. What about the fact that the courts already give them excessive time to come up with back rent? What about the time that they cannot be evicted between November and March, and they know this? And many already know how to play the court system without the skills of a lawyer. Speaking from experience here, the city's laws are extremely skewed towards the tenant in these cases. It also overlooks and penalizes landlords who comply, keep their properties up to date, respond to tenants, etc. That is obviously a landlord's point of view.
Well, it's certainly a landlord's point of view, and it's not one that I think there are others who
share
that. I'm not
sure Cynthia's a landlord.
Real fast to know, we're not talking about Buzzard Point anymore. We're now jumping to the eviction and access to justice issue. But here's what I think you have to keep in mind. We are not talking about changing the legal relationship. When an individual owes back rent, they still have to owe that money. It doesn't change the expectations. The tenant still has to pay rent and pay for what they are receiving and to
Many
pay for housing.
Many often don't pay, though. They simply don't have the money to
they
pay
don't.
Or they choose not
but
to pay.
But what you will find frequently, what the experience is in other cities, when you have representation, that attorney, their job is to get to a resolution. So whereas right now, I think what you'll hear from some landlords who perhaps don't like this idea, you will see cases that drag out and drag out and drag out. And what an attorney can do is help get to a resolution. Because when an attorney's job is to help bring this to resolution, they're not saying, how do I find somebody who can't afford this anyway, but let me just keep them in there? Because you cannot change the expectations. You cannot change the law around this. If you got to pay the rent, you got to pay the rent. But what an attorney can do is help bring it to resolution faster. The experience that we've seen in other cities is that they get to a settlement more quickly, and they also move on for everyone's benefit. So that landlord can go find a rent-paying tenant who will move into that unit and then thus bring revenue in for the landlord. And for the tenant, you also find a better solution for them, which moves them back out and into more appropriate housing or better housing, and doesn't in the process spin them down, ruin their credit, and destroy their ability to find stable housing.
There are terrible tenants and there are terrible landlords. And you're just trying to, in the big middle, take care of this.
This is all about creating fairness and justice and a more equitable system, but it will lead to resolutions that are fairer, and frankly, they are more quickly resolved.
Unless you have a specific question, I have
We only have about a minute.
You're one of the most liberal, progressive councils. I hear it all the time from people. Some say it's a good thing, others, that you're the most liberal council since the council was created in the 1970s. How would you characterize your 13 council members? Are you the most liberal ever?
Ooh. Well, I think that everything has to be in context, but I would say you got 13 council members and you got 13 different perspectives and viewpoints. I know when I talk to my colleagues, I get a different perspective from each one of them. I get a very thoughtful perspective. We don't all agree on every single issue. I can't think of all that many issues where we start from the exact same point. What I hope, though, as a legislative body, is that we talk to one another. We try to help convince each other of different ideas. We hear each other and hear each other's concerns. And then more often than not, we do try to build towards a consensus together. But, it's easy to kind of toss around what's the most progressive, what's the most liberal. It's all in context. But I find 13 unique individuals on this council that are all, I think, in their own way, trying to move our city forward.
And finally, this email from Chris about precisely that. I may not always agree with D.C. Council budget decisions, but I do believe the district is lucky to have a legislative body that is smart and focused and not afraid to dig into the details of uncomfortable issues. Alan is part of the good stuff that happens at that council. We don't necessarily agree with that, but Chris obviously.
Well, you know, it was a little too sugary. I think it's too much sugary sweet in that.
But definitely.
Last time you were on, I asked if you were going to ever run for mayor. What is that? You laughed. Were you still laughing?
I think you asked me, was I running for mayor last time I was here?
Yes.
And I said, no, I love what I do in Ward 6. I love this job. I love working for the different neighborhoods. I love
You'd never
working
run
with
for
the people
mayor.
Of Ward 6. You know, this is what this I'm looking
this
to do.
This is the one
right
they can't
now.
Answer. This is exactly. the one they can never answer.
Charles Allen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you both so
After
much.
After that sugary sweet thing you said, I had to
we
bring
should do
Charles,
more of that.
Allen's a member of the D.C. Council. He's a Democrat representing Ward 6. Coming up next, Mark Eldridge. He is an at-large Montgomery County Council member. He is a Democrat. But first, Tom Sherwood, there's a telephone call that is really for you. Here is Brianna in Quantico. Brianna, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey. I was calling because... I heard that you said that the director of communication is out of a job.
Yes.
And I was calling to ask who I need to contact to apply for it.
Well, apparently you can contact Tom Sherwood.
Well, I'm not the employee relations manager for the mayor's office, but I would say Mayor Muriel Bowser runs the city, and you use your skills of getting to know things by figuring out how you get in touch with the mayor's office. I think there's even a place on the web where you can actually apply. But you have to live in the city. It'd be one bottom line thing. But she, you know, she could use some good help. She's about to run for reelection.
Gotcha. Okay.
Thank you very much for your call. Joining us in studio now is Mark Eldridge. He is an at-large Montgomery County Council member. He is a Democrat. Mark Eldridge, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
He's another one of those progressives.
If you have questions or comments for Mark Eldridge, call us at 800-433-8850. Send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream of the broadcast. Ask a question or make a comment. Shoot us a tweet at kojoshow. Mark Eldridge, I'd like to start with the news that's coming out today about Governor Hogan vetoing the bill that would have required employers to provide paid sick leaves. He called the measure a deeply flawed, job-killing paid leave bill. He says studies show it would cost thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in lost economic activity. That, of course, from the Washington Times. Tom Sherwood identified you as a progressive, so I can imagine how you feel about that veto, but please speak for yourself.
10 years on the council in Tacoma Park.
19. Who,
19? Oh, 10, 10, 10 terms. 10 right. terms. I'm sorry, 19 years. So go right ahead.
That does it. Huh?
Dig yourself out of that.
You guys are always so friendly. So I'm a big believer in sick leave.
Yeah.
And I don't see how we expect people to manage their lives if they're expected to go in sick. I don't see why if you're an employer and you were in the food service business or any kind of customer service business, you would want sick people coming into work because they felt they desperately had to come into work. It just doesn't make sense as a public policy. I think that, you know, since I'm a progressive, I think there are a few things in society that we have to make some adjustments to. One is health insurance. One is things like paid sick leave. Another one is a decent wage. And if the business community could wrap its head around modifying their positions on that and making adjustments to that, I think that we could go forward in a lot more positive way.
Where does it stand, just so we'll know, do you have an opportunity to override the veto, or is it that's now done and you have to go back next year?
The legislature could come back and override it, or they can override it like they did at the beginning of this year in January. They went right after several of his bills and they overrode them. So I expect one way or the other they'll get overridden.
On to Montgomery County. Newly instituted term limits in the county mean a lot of jockeying for office in next year's primary. Political musical chairs is how one article characterized it. And indeed, you will be term limited out of your council seat, and you have officially declared you are running for county executive. So I think you did that, so Tom Sherwood wouldn't have to ask you again. Which means we are now authorized to put you through the ringer on the show. Will this shakeup ultimately be good for the leadership of the county?
I'm really concerned about the way the elections are going to pan out, because we passed public financing, and a lot of people, I think, are going to go into the public financing route, but they're going to discover that it's a lot harder to raise money than one would think. The multiplier that's involved in different races and the number of signatures you have to get to qualify are all pretty high barriers. I mean, I was an at-large council member, and I raised as many donations last time as it would take me to qualify for the 40,000 in the initial 500, right, you know, donations. So, and then after that, it would take like another 1,000 donations. So you're talking about magnitudes of donations that have never been received in public campaigns. Meanwhile, people who don't want to do that can say, what the heck, if my opponents doing public financing are handicapped and not able to raise enough money, they can't say much about me. And we have no media in this town. You know, you guys are great, but there's very little. The Post doesn't cover it very much.
Terrible. So no one, Turk will not like this.
Well, he knows they don't cover Montgomery County. Montgomery County is not a priority for the Post. So people aren't going to know what people's sources of money are. And you're going to get one of those things called PACs. There's already one in Montgomery County that's going to claim we're the PAC for schools and beautiful world and all that stuff, and tell you what their candidates, the people they support, will do, and will be utterly silent on how they're going to raise the money to do any of that stuff. So I've seen this act before, and it makes me nervous.
And so you are right. You have a formal campaign announcement already?
We did it in we kicked off a couple months ago. We've already done our first house parties. Yeah,
running for Ike Leggett couldn't run again.
Right. But
how much? He is term limited.
Yes, he is.
How much money? Also, you might just be done.
How much? Heard that, Ike?
What's a county race going to cost? Several people are going to possibly get in. So what's a county race like that cost in terms of raising dollars? Have you got a ballpark figure that you are shooting for?
So if you could reach the maximum match in Montgomery County, it would take you around 1,500 contributions to get to $150,000 if your average contribution is $100. And that would get you $750,000 total. Now, that's about what Ike won on the first time he ran, but subsequent elections have cost more. And, you know, Steve Silverman, I think, was north of $2 million. Duncan was north of $2 million. So people who avoid the system may well find lots of money. But if you're inside the public finance system, you'll be lucky.
Will you criticize people who don't do public financing?
Absolutely. If your money's coming from the real estate development industry, I mean, if one message came out of the term limits thing, was people wanted to get rid of a council they thought was too heavily influenced by developers. So if you're going to go out there and run on a campaign that basically is paid for by the development community, God bless you and good luck. And if anybody pulls the covers off that, that's going to be a very difficult position to take.
Big picture for your campaign. The county faces a number of challenges, including expanding enrollment in schools, debates over development, residents who are feeling overtaxed after a huge hike last year. What direction does the council need to be heading in now, and how, under your leadership, will it get there in 10 words or less?
Yeah. Well, I'll assure you of one thing. I don't believe in hope, so I'm not going to tell you hope for the best.
Okay.
I think that, you know, we have to look at a number of things. If we're going to do development, we have to make a decision. We're going to attach infrastructure to it, and we're going to have the people who benefit the most from our rezoning of property and massively increasing the wealth generated by that property. They're going to have to kick in a greater share of what it's going to cost to take to build the infrastructure. And it's especially true in schools. I mean, we keep telling people, don't worry about our plans. You know, we can manage the traffic and we'll manage the schools. And our record is we haven't managed the traffic and we haven't managed the schools.
Can we be more specific on that? Yesterday, the county council approved the Bethesda downtown plan. Yours was the lone dissenting vote. You've been described as the anti-development candidate. So I'm going to ask you what issues you have with the plan. And Montgomery County and Bethesda in particular is divided on the issue of development. How, going forward as county executive, would you reconcile the opposing views on how the county grows?
So I think this is a classic example of how people have tried to pitch a story that this is all about NIMBYs, and like I'm the, you know, Duncan, I think, referred to me as the king of the NIMBYs, and totally ignoring the fact that the residents didn't have any problem with the amount of density. And I didn't have any problem with the amount of density. So people weren't saying you shouldn't build here. What they were saying is that you've got enough density and enough of the area of Bethesda to develop in that you could use all that density and not come near the edges and not come near the neighborhoods. And that made sense because I believe, you know, if you supposedly, quote-unquote, Montgomery County believes that we're supposed to be doing transit-oriented development, commercial development and residential development should have been kept close to the metro. If you believe in smart growth principles, commercial development should be in the first quarter mile ring. Residential development should be between a quarter and a half. I thought we should have come up with a more orderly plan about where development can go rather than saying the first guy, it's literally what the system is. The first guy comes to the bar with money, can buy additional density and add it to his property. And it could be in the core where it belongs, but it could also be at the edges where it doesn't belong. So my objection primarily was that there are two things that the residents said were essential, and the plan said it would balance the traffic and that it would address the park's needs. We have no mechanism for raising money for the parks. Our own staff has told us you'll be lucky if you get a few of the priority parks. So we sell the community that we're going to make this community beautiful with all these parks, and we know damn well that we don't have any mechanism for raising the money. And on the traffic issue, we're told the plan will be in balance and we have to have this mode share. And for those of you who don't know what I mean by mode share, it's the percentage of people.
What's the word?
Mode.
M-O-D-E?
Yeah. So it's the number of people who use transit versus auto. And right. Bethesda calls for a balance with 55% non-auto driver mode share. And at the last minute, when we were questioning him and we were talking about staging, and they objected to staging. It's like, why do you object to staging? We're gonna achieve this mode balance. And they said, well, actually, that'll be 15 or 20 years. Yes, and that's on tape. So if you're going to build all this stuff and not bring it in balance, and our own staff said to us, guys, you have the ability to do this. This is a political choice. And so we were not willing to make the political choices to adopt policies to bring the plans into balance. And people are angry with us. I mean, we've already told them, we've already shown them we can't manage their traffic. They've got terrible problems with the schools. And if we don't do the things to demonstrate to people that we're going to put the infrastructure in place, I think we lose people's faith. And
Politically, how would it be different if you were to win the county executive job? George Leventhal is running, Roger Berliner may, Craig Rice may, Ben Kramer may, Robin Ficker is looking at it from another mm-hmm. angle. It sounds like a lot of people who are not, there are not a lot of new faces in this race to be the county executive. So if you get elected, how much different would it be?
Well,
have a majority to do what you think is right?
Well, I think if I got elected, it would send a pretty strong signal to people about, you know, what they expect the council to do, number one. And I think there are going to be candidates running who share the concerns, are going to echo the concerns of the neighborhoods. And I think, you know, the whole reason I proposed the bus rapid transit system, which now goes back 8 years, was looking at the county and trying to figure out how do you provide enough transit to accommodate the amount of development we have. And so when people, you know, say, well, you're the anti-development guy, it's like I'm the only one that ever came up with a plan to get enough cars off the road so you could actually do development. So I plan on aggressively pursuing things and working with the council to come up with solutions. I don't want there to be a stop. But there's got to be a way to go forward.
Okay, let me quick political question. We talked about Virginia, the record number of women running for office. How come there are no women running for county executive? You guys seem to close the door on them.
I neither open doors nor close doors to, you know, who runs for county executive. You'd have to ask people in the community why they don't do that.
Well, here's Jim in Boyds, Maryland with a question for you. Put on your headphones, please, so you can hear Jim. Jim, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. I appreciate you for taking my call. My comment is talking about financing for running for county office. It's all well and good, and it makes for good radio, but what you need to be talking about are the pay raises that the council members have voted for themselves over the years and how the county is very discouraging for military retirees like myself to live in the county. I can hardly afford to live here. If my family wasn't here, I wouldn't. So you should be talking about what the bureaucracy in Montgomery County, just because you're close to the federal government doesn't need to be to run like the federal government. And you need to be keeping costs down, including the schools. The schools, it's just outrageous the amount of money that are given to the schools. And my wife works at the schools, and so I know that the schools are given a huge amount of money. Yes, we do have good schools, but there's a limit. I want a lot of things. I want to have hair. but I'm bald and I'm not going to get hair.
Well, so, the schools are overfinanced, and it's very difficult for a retired veteran to be able to live in the county. How do you respond?
I don't believe the schools are overfinanced. We have a school system that's dealing with increasing problems of poverty and the impacts of poverty.
And diversity.
These are not just
white picket fences homes anymore. That's a huge diversity. 100 different languages someone taught.
100, more than 100. And I taught in the public schools. I taught for 17 years in one of the most
fourth and fifth, one
of the most diverse schools in the county. And you cannot teach in a classroom where kids are at radically different grade levels. In fifth grade, with kids reading in the first grade level and the fifth grade level, that is a world different than teaching in a classroom where everybody's working at the same level. So I believe pretty strongly that we need to make the investments. Do I think that the schools could look more closely at how they spend money? Absolutely. And as county executive, if I get elected, there are some things I really want to change. I want to alter our procurement policies. I think there are opportunities for more effective procurements of goods or services in the county. And I really think we need to look at how the county government is structured. And I know that our union partners are actually engaged in an exercise in Prince George's County where they're acknowledging, how do we make ourselves sustainable? We cannot and we will not be able to continually raise taxes to meet needs. And I believe we have to look within existing budgets for savings to do some of the new stuff we want to do.
And you have a growing, the boomer generation, my generation, growing retirement. People would like to stay in their homes. The good news is the value of their homes has gone up. The bad news, property taxes have gone up too, and then their incomes drop when they retire. Even with the military retirement, people find it hard to cover their costs. I don't know what can be done about that other than trimming the number of increases. What was it, 9% last year?
It was a one-shot thing.
One-shot thing. And a one-shot thing until the next one-shot thing.
But we've pretty much avoided one-shot
things.
If you look at Ike's budget, and I challenge anybody to look at the county executive's budget, he underspent so much the previous 12 years. I mean, his was a downward-tracking budget. We're basically same services. We struggle to maintain even the programming that we were doing the previous year. We are, you know, partly just caught up in inflation, but that's, I would agree with the gentleman on his point that we could do things more efficiently and better, and I feel really obligated to do it. Like, one of my pet things is I think we have to do something about early childhood.
Got
to
talk about the Purple Line. The federal district judge ruling on the Purple Line ordered another impact review of the light rail line, a ruling that the state says it may not be able to appeal. That ruling and the delay it would require jeopardizes the $5.8 billion public-private partnership and the $900 million in federal funding. Where do things stand, and could this entire project be at risk? And I guess most importantly, what would that mean for Montgomery County?
Well, the project could be at risk. I'd say fortunately in Montgomery County, there aren't a lot of developments that are contingent on it. There may be things where people say, if this gets built, I might make an investment, but
it's more important to Prince George's.
Probably more important to them, but there's no place other than Chevy Chase Lakes, which is like a blip on the radar, where it actually makes a difference between whether you can go forward and do things. We have another transit project, the Quarter Cities Transit Way, where the entire Science City is locked off to additional development until we figure out how to do that. So I don't think that it produces an impossible problem for Montgomery County in terms of development, but it's definitely a corridor that needs east-west transportation, and so we would lose the opportunity. I would hope we'd come back with another way of addressing it. You know, I've been the author of the BRT plan, and you could do BRT there as a fallback if you couldn't do rail, but I think we need to do something. But I frankly thought the judge was pretty clear what he wanted the first time. It baffles me why the state just didn't do a study and say, you know, okay, you want to study, here's your study, as opposed to, we think the old study is good enough, we stand by it. You could almost guarantee that the judge was going to say, that's not what I asked for.
Right. Judge Leon has a pretty good reputation, except for the people who are really angry at him, what he's done for this Purple Line.
I've got a friend who once got sentenced to a year for something, and because his approach when he talked to the judge was, I don't see what the big deal is. Now he was able to remedy that upon further review. But I think when, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but the way I read it was the judge is pretty clear what he asked for. And we just should have given him what he asked for and gone on with it.
You know, the...
We only have about a minute and a half left.
Oh, my goodness.
That's so sad.
Larry Hogan's running for re-election. What are the Democrats going to do? You're going to be running for county executive. That you got to focus on that. But who do you want to be the Democratic candidate for governor in this race that's going to be starting right now?
I kind of want to see what people have to say. You know, there's nobody who's laid out and said, this is my vision, this is what
I... You don't have a candidate.
So I'm not... there are people I like, and there are people I'm less sure of. And I want to see how they sort themselves out.
Did you support Anthony Brown's campaign for governor four years ago?
Yes.
Everybody did. He lost.
Right.
He
wasn't my first choice for candidate. But
I'm just wondering. Larry Hogan seems to be dancing around the Democrats a little bit here. It's going to be tough to beat next year, maybe, unless people take Trump out on him.
I think Hogan is very smart, but I think when push comes to shove on, like, a minimum wage and on...
Paid family leave
and some other stuff.
Sick leave.
It's a little bit harder for them. They did a masterful job on fracking.
We got an
political
email from
brilliance.
Ed in Bethesda, who says, the combination of term limits, public financing, and the awakening of movement supporting populist policies is producing a large number of committed progressives who could create a powerful base on the county council to see the kinds of changes that council member Elrich will need if he's elected county executive. Changes in the air. Are you sponsoring a ticket, so to speak? Are you going to have people running with you?
No, I'm not sponsoring a ticket. I mean, I've talked to a bunch of people. I'll be interested in who gets into the race and, more importantly, who's viable when you get, you know, get past January and everybody's registered. But, you know, I've served on a council where I obviously disagree pretty strongly, but I've been able to get some pretty important legislation through despite having differences.
The question is whether this progressive blip is more than a blip. And we won't know until we get into the races.
Mark Elrich, he's an at-large Montgomery County Council member. You'll obviously be hearing more from him on this broadcast since he's now running for county executive. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll meet you back here on Tuesday at noon when we'll talk about how the e-commerce boom is changing our relationship with the region's infrastructure and causing a lot of traffic jams. That's on Tuesday at noon. Until then, Tom, will you be riding your motorcycle with Rolling Thunder this weekend?
No, but I'll bike over there and watch them come past the Lincoln Memorial, which is always an inspiring thing, and I'll check out the parade on Monday, and then I'll practice more of my reading for the preschool kids.
Thank you for sharing your entire weekend's activities with us. Until then, thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schroepsdorf, Ruth Tam, Avery Kleiman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Cliff Gallagher has been on the phones. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.